Hi, friends. This is Anita, and I just want to let you know that today's podcast is amazing. Christy Purifoy is my guest, and she is the author of Placemaker, Cultivating Places of Comfort, Beauty, and Peace. It is a high-quality conversation. I had some technical issues about the first 10 minutes of the podcast. It is certainly, you can hear it, but a couple of times there are like some crackly stuff. I just want to let you know that after 10 minutes, all of that is gone and it is perfect from there on out. I'm bummed that I have to even tell you this, but just want to give you that disclaimer because I don't want anyone to quit listening. So enjoy the rest of the podcast. I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Well, I'm excited to have on the podcast today Christy Purifoy, and you are going to love this conversation. I know you are, because we're going to talk about her book, Placemaker. Don't you just love that name? And it just elicits all kinds of thoughts and probably pictures in your mind. At least that's what I hope. And we're going to get into that conversation in just a quick moment. I ran into a couple of people this last week that asked about supporting the podcast, and I realized that I hadn't talked about that in a few episodes. It's really easy. On the homepage at anitalustria.com, right down at the bottom, there's this little icon that's a P. It's the first one in the series of icons where there's Twitter and Facebook, all that. And that's Patreon, and you can go on and just go to patreon.com/faithconversations, and you can, give per episode. And you can choose to give a buck or more or whatever you want to give that would help support the podcast. And others of you, I know, prefer to give via PayPal. You can do that by going to PayPal and using producer@anitalustria.com as the email. Some of you prefer to mail a check, and I understand that as well. Just mail it to 8 White Oak Terrace, Sarasota, Florida, 34237, and you can back up the podcast if you didn't get all that. You can rewind and get that, so I won't say that again. All right, friends, Christy Purifoy is here with me today. One of the things that is interesting to me, and I'm going to ask her about, she earned a PhD in English literature at the University of Chicago before trading the classroom for an old farmhouse, a garden, and a writing desk. She has authored Roots and Sky, A Journey Home in Four Seasons, and the book we're going to talk about today, Placemaker. And she lives with her husband and four children at Maplehurst, a Victorian farmhouse in southeastern Pennsylvania, which, don't you just want to move there with them? Yes, just reading that. So, Christy, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Thank you, Anita. It's so good to be here. I know it sounds dreamy on paper, but if any of your listeners read the book Placemaker, they'll know just how overwhelming it can be.
It's a lot of work. But you're right. It sounds dreamy on paper. That's a good way of putting it. And we really do long for the dreamy part of, you know, what we're hearing in that word placemaker and the home Maplehurst. You know, we do long for that. We're going to talk about what some of that is about in a few moments. Christy, did you ever teach English? You know, when you got your PhD, what were you doing in your other life before today?
I did, right. I had every intention of being a full-time academic, being an English professor. It was my dream for many, many years. And I finished the degree. We moved to Florida, and I did some part-time teaching at the University of North Florida. But it was during that season that became a real wilderness season for me that, God uses hard times to get my attention. And the result is that I gave up that dream of an academic career, and I had another baby. I started writing online. I started writing openly about my faith. My life has taken a turn I never expected, never could have predicted. But hardly a day goes by that I don't, while grieving some of the losses of that dream, I also just say, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. God knows us so much better than we know ourselves, and I feel like I'm living the life I was made for. It's just not the life I planned on.
Great statement. God knows us so much better than we know ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we plan and we move towards something and then things happen. And
that's right.
We need to discern the way forward, right?
That's right.
And it's never easy.
You know, I'm learning that it's not easy and there's certainly loss, but gosh, one thing now, quite a few years on, I'd say about 8 or 9 years on from that initial decision to walk a different path, one thing that's been so surprising to me is that I've realized that nothing is wasted and God returns all kinds of things that we never expected to be returned to us. So even though I'm not doing the formal full-time teaching that I expected, I have lately found all kinds of opportunities for teaching in other ways. And so it has felt like the return of something or almost as if some long-buried seed is now bearing fruit. And it's been surprising and surprisingly sweet, actually.
Love hearing that. And I think that also gives a lot of us hope when we hear someone else's story like this, because I was working with a group of women just last night. We were finishing up a book study at church, and I was teaching them the spiritual practice of a rule of life. And I'm a spiritual director, and so I love teaching spiritual practices. And this one is a great one to end a study with, but the reminder is there that we need to change that rule of life, those rhythms of life, with each season. And sometimes those seasons can be quick. They could be maybe 6 months long. Sometimes they can be years long. But, life has its twists and turns, and there are shifts in how we connect with God and how we move forward into those seasons.
It's true. You know, the seasons have always been a sort of language of creation that's spoken to me. And I'm a gardener as well as a writer. And the things I've learned in the garden about how the garden works, I don't think that they're just metaphors for our spiritual lives or our lives in this world. I think they tell us something very true about how everything operates, how everything functions, that we need these seasons of dormancy, of rest, even of barrenness and emptiness, that those are absolutely necessary for new life to grow, for abundant harvest. It's just the way it all works. And so learning that in the garden has helped me so much to sort of let go and receive what's different in each season, even if I don't understand fully what the purpose is. I think it's helped a lot with being able to trust the wisdom of each season and just enter into it more fully.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Yes. And I just go back to that season metaphor, and just to remind people, you know, in Roots and Sky, that was your first book, is that true?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, the subtitle, I mentioned it earlier, but A Journey Home in 4 Seasons. And that might be a great place to start, but you're going to want to move on to Placemaker, I know that.
Sure, and, but that is a good place to start.
Yeah, I think so, to get to know you. As always, in the show notes and on the website, I will list all the ways to learn more about Christy. ChristyPurifoy.com is a great place to go, because I know you regularly blog there, and I enjoy getting those delivered to my inbox, and I know others will want that as well. Christy, I want to hear a little bit of your history, and I'm not exactly sure where to begin as we move toward learning more about Maplehurst. But I'm curious to hear what is in your home history. After you married, along the way, you know, there have been several moves before arriving at Maplehurst. And I think that's also kind of hopeful for us to hear about, because, you know, a lot of us are in transition. Like, I think that my husband and I are at our last home move on this planet, so which feels really good, and it's a place I love. And I actually wrote in the margins of questions to talk to you about that I want to name our home because of reading your book, and I want to hear a little bit more about how Maplehurst got its name, if you named it, or if this home came with a name. So, but I want to hear your home history a little bit here.
Yeah, well, just like in the subtitle, The Roof and Sky, A Journey Home in Four Seasons, I think homecoming is it's a process. It's never a moment. And for me, it's been a lifelong process. I grew up in Texas, and I don't know how many of your listeners might relate to this, but even as a child, I never felt quite like I belonged there. I was so bothered by the heat and the lack of real seasons and the mosquitoes in summer, and I always felt a little uncomfortable in my environment. And now I can see the real value of that. I think it got me searching and leaning into new desires. And so I did. I married young, and my husband and I moved around for jobs and school, lived in many places. Some of them felt like home. Some of them were easy to love. Some of them did not feel like home and were really challenging to love. But, you know, I've learned that even those difficult places, the places that are harder for us to love, the places where we don't feel like we fit, they, if we're willing to try to sink our roots in, even if we're not going to be there forever, that every place can nourish us in some way. Every place has some gifts to give. And I feel like I've received gifts living in small towns and little apartments. We lived for 10 years in the big city of Chicago. Loved that, although it wasn't always easy to live there. But all along, I think I was leaning into a desire that many of us share for a real home, you know, just that comforting sense of at-homeness. And I think that's a God-given desire, a God-planted desire. And I'll be honest, I think it's too easy to say, well, this earth is not our home and we can never feel at home here. I think that's almost a shortcut we sometimes take to really kind of lean into what that desire might, you know, be drawing out of us. And so I've never, as painful as it is, I've never shortcut that. I've always said, oh God, I want a home, leave me home. And he has graciously done that. Never perfectly, never completely. It's a process that is still ongoing, even here at Maplehurst. And yet I do feel more at home in this place than I've ever felt anywhere else.
I love that you said that. I love that you said we can kind of shortcut that, you know, talk about this world is not our home. And I think what happens is you talk some about this too, that we toss beauty to the side and say that it really is a waste of time, or cutting to the chase with some of these phrases, but in essence, we can do this. And I've personally spent a chunk of my lifetime learning how to appreciate beauty, and which is part of my growth edge in learning how to play.
Oh, yes.
Because I was not a player. I was a very serious kid and kind of, you know, committed my life in a really serious way to Jesus at age 5. And that had big overarching influence for good, mm-hmm. but we can lose our way in that as well and not realize
so true.
It, right?
So true. You know, I'm a firstborn, high-achieving, people-pleasing girl, follow the rules and make sure it counts do it right. And I've walked that path for many years, and yet deep down in me was this, I was just drawn to beauty.
Yep.
And, you know, it took me years before I could acknowledge that as something God had planted in me. A poet I love, Lucy Shaw, writes about beauty as like visible, tangible grace from God. It's his grace, his abundant grace and his love just made tangible in the world. And I think, oh, what a shame when he has filled the world with that, and we refuse to see it, and we refuse to stop and acknowledge it, and we refuse to participate in it and cultivate it in our places, which is really what the book Placemaker is all about. And I think, oh, he must just look at us and think, oh, if only,
right.
you'd stop moving so fast, slow down a little.
Well, and I'm a lover of music and grew up listening to a lot of Christian music, but a couple of songs, or one song that I really gravitated toward that I love, an old one by Stephen Curtis Chapman on a love song album that he wrote, is called Echoes of Eden.
Ooh.
And you know, the you know, I don't know the exact wording, but or what the word is I'm looking for, but that we have the opportunity to enjoy here in this life some beautiful things that indeed are echoes of Eden that point back and point forward.
Yes.
You know, yes. And to not miss those things, to not miss mm-hmm. that. You know, he was talking relationally, but the song, obviously, a larger overarching theme goes well beyond just the relational component. And another favorite songwriter of mine is Sarah Groves, who writes uh-huh. just beautiful songs. And I pulled out her song this morning. I wanted to look at her lyrics to add to the beauty. As I was thinking about your book, I wanted to see if it, you know, kind of corresponded. And she talks about, I want to add to the beauty to tell a better story. I want to shine with the light that's burning up inside. It comes in loving community. It comes in helping a soul find its worth. Redemption comes in strange places, small spaces, calling out the best of who we are. And I would just add to that, you know, she's probably talking about redemption comes in strange places, small spaces. But I in a different meaning to that, but I think in the physical spaces that you're talking about in your book mm-hmm. can be added into that meaning there. Right?
Oh, that's right. You know, one of the most surprising things to me has been that God will use places not only to communicate with us, but to be present with us and to offer comfort and peace in ways that I'm just not sure would be possible otherwise. So, you know, one recent example in my family, you know, I for many years thought about planting a flower garden here at Maplehurst. And, you know, I love flowers, but oh my goodness, talk about impractical. You know, you can't cook a flower, you can't eat a flower. So for years I put it off thinking, well, some flowers you can, although I don't know if they're not as nutritious maybe as the carrots and the spinach, but I put it off just thinking, oh, what, that's too self-indulgent. How could I spend the time and the money to plant a formal flower garden here? And but finally, with my husband's encouragement, I did it. And in the first year of that flower garden, when it was really establishing and the roses were blooming, well, that was the year that my sister, younger sister, unexpectedly lost her husband. And she had four young kids, and it was a really difficult time for our family. But one thing that happened is that she brought her kids in the month of June to stay with us. And we spent every day in that flower garden just receiving comfort and rest and soaking in the beauty. And in my memory, every day it was just glorious. And God was present with us in, you know, in our pain in a way in that garden that I just can't imagine happening in another space. And so I think, oh, the irony that all along, you know, God was inviting me to do something that I wanted to do because he knew, you know, he could use it to comfort us and to help restore us and heal us. And so we just never know, you know, when we're called to create beauty, to cultivate it, we just never know how much is at stake.
I love that story. It reminds me, someone this last week posted a picture of a little pansy patch. Well, it took me back to childhood. My grandfather was a farmer in northern Maine, and I was born in Maine and have spent a lot of time up there. He passed away young. He was young and I was young. I lost him when I was 10. There are so many questions I want to ask him because while he grew vegetables and was a kind of a truck garden farmer with a lot of potatoes, which is what is often also grown in northern Maine, he always grew a small field of just pansies and several rows of gladiolus.
Oh, how interesting.
Would always take bouquets to church.
Oh.
And I wish he were alive. I would love to have my adult sensibilities be able to interact with him and ask, you know, Grandpa, why did you choose to mm-hmm. also grow pansies besides mm-hmm. the vegetables and fruits?
That speaks powerfully.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Early on, I underlined this quote, if our hearts have been shaped by grace and faith, we bend beneath a heavy new burden of guilt. Aren't we meant to engage a hurting world rather than retreat to our own private Edens? And I think you I think you nail it. I think we have this sense of guilt. Oh, shouldn't we be about other things, not our mm-hmm. own personal comfort? But we don't see the whole picture. And we are whole beings.
That's right.
Speak mm-hmm. about your own journey through that thought, because I'm sure, dealt with that.
Yeah, it is. It's so easy to think that time and energy and even finances spent on our own spaces and places, that is frivolous, or, we can do that with our extra time or extra money. But I've really come to see it as I'll just say it as a holy calling, as a way of loving others and a way of receiving God's love. So I won't even say that it's worthwhile only if you share your space with other people. I think hospitality is an important part of placemaking. I love sharing my spaces with other people. I love gardening in part because then other people will get to, come into the garden and be blessed by that beauty. But I don't think that we only do this for other people. I think we do this because it's a part of leaning into, our kind of divine DNA as image bearers. Our God is a placemaking God. Not only did he create the earth, but he carved out special places within it, the garden, the temple, the promised land, all of it. And I think when we aren't willing to do that ourselves, we're not living fully. We're not living completely. And so it's not just, I can cook a nice dinner if someone else is coming over, but maybe sometimes it's okay to just set a nice table and sit down and serve yourself and become in the process, I think, more fully alive.
You know what? I appreciate you saying that. You go on to say, in the book, you say, "I know absolutely making and tending good and beautiful places is not a dishonorable retreat. It is a holy pursuit. Our Maker has made a home for us, sheltered by trees, bounded by rivers, and illuminated by both stars and the white blooming flowers of evening." And I'm just going to go on and read this because I want people to know this about your book, Placemaker. This book is an invitation to reconsider your own relationship to the ground beneath your feet and the roof over your head. Because I think we can come to that place where we reconsider our thoughts about the ground beneath our feet, because there's so mm-hmm. much talk about creation care.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I don't think we take it further to the roof over our head.
That's true, isn't it?
And, yes. And to your last comment, I also want to raise this. I am in a community that is that has a lot of widows and widowers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes and I'll talk about younger singles as well, we can think that we are not worth that effort.
Yes, that makes so much sense.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a lie, isn't it? It's so wrong. Yeah.
Yeah. But sometimes we need reminding of this. I think that's one of the reasons I love what you write about. And move me on if I've covered this ground before, but have you already talked about what you mean, what the word placemaker means? Because I've been over here fidgeting with knobs and buttons to make this sound good.
I don't think I have. I feel like for many years I was a woman in search of a bigger word, a more spacious word, a word like, let's just like homemaking just wasn't quite big enough. And it certainly didn't include my husband as well in the work. And, it comes with cultural baggage and we use it for particular things. So I just needed a bigger word that would kind of capture, my love of place and placemaking is it. So what I mean by it is, not only a willingness to shape a place for the better, to tend it, to care for it, but also, and I think this is courageous, the willingness to sink your roots in deep. Mm-hmm. Even if you think I won't be living here forever, even if you know I have moved and moved and it hurts so much to love a place and then to lose it, or you're living in an apartment or home where you think, well, it's just for me, how much does it matter? But I think it takes courage to sink your roots in deep to a place and let yourself be shaped by a place, transformed by it, nourished by it, listen to a place. You know, I write a lot about the history of different places in Placemaker because I think, you know, learning the history of a place can be one way that a place can care for us.
This is so, so interesting. I look back at my personal history and the year after I graduated college, so many years ago, 1980, 81 to 82, I traveled with a singing group for a year. And about six weeks in, there were just three women and three men in this group. The other two young women said to me, "Anita, you have closed yourself off from us, and this is going to be a long year." Ah. I realized I had made a bunch of moves leading up to that year, and I thought, this is only going to be a year. Saying goodbye is so hard and so painful. Right. I cannot open my heart because mm-hmm. this is going to hurt at the end of a year. Mm-hmm. But they called me on it. They saw it. I don't think I even fully saw that I had said this to myself, you know. Mm-hmm. And I broke down, and the result was that I did open up. I'm so grateful that they pointed this out, and it was a wonderful year, a difficult year, but an important year. And mm-hmm. it would have looked so different and so devoid of meaning, and just I just for me to wither along, it would have been horrible.
Yes.
So I'm grateful. Yes. So I love that you said that. Even if we think we're not going to be somewhere for long, mm-hmm. it's hard. It can be very hard to make a move. And I've talked a lot about it here on the podcast. Listeners know Mike and I transitioned to Sarasota, Florida, about 2.5 years ago, after 2 years in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you start over, no history with people, no, you know, and you just, it's a lot of small talk before you can get to the good talk. And it's, all that stuff is hard. And you're praying that you'll find friends that will mean as much as friends have in the past, even though you still retain those relationships. They shift. You can't meet face-to-face for coffee with them anymore. It's a text mm-hmm. conversation, you know, all this. Mm-hmm. And I started recently picking up some history books to read about the history of Sarasota.
Ah.
And I've learned all kinds of things about Bertha Honoré Palmer and that they owned the Palmer House in Chicago. So there's been this Chicago connection that has warmed my heart. That Sarasota at one time by a paper in Joliet outside of Chicago was called in the early 20s. It's Sarasota has virtually become a Chicago suburb. Isn't that
That's incredible.
Funny? Yes. So,
I love that.
I'm starting to get more connected to this area.
Yes. Both. Oh, it's incredible. Yeah.
So I don't think I saw that history, knowing the history of an area, would do that for me. So to hear you just say that, it's like, ding, this little light bulb is going on above my head right now.
Do you know, I had a similar experience. And it's so true. When we move a lot or even just have one really significant move, it can feel as if the parts of our lives are now disconnected, as if there's been some rupture that I think God longs to heal. And so one thing he did for me too, so I grew up in a little town in Texas. And now I live in this little town in Pennsylvania. And when I was doing research for the book, I knew some of this history, but discovered more as I was writing. I made a connection between that small Texas town and my Pennsylvania town, and the connection comes through roses. So my town in Pennsylvania was known as Home of the Roses. It was full of rose growers, and the little post office here was one of the busiest in the country, shipping out roses all across the country. Huh. And many of those roses went west with pioneers to Texas, where now people are cultivating those old varieties, and they're restoring them to commerce. And so there is this line between my little Pennsylvania town and my little Texas town, and the link is the history of these gorgeous antique roses.
Wow.
I mean, of all things.
That's amazing.
It makes me feel a cohesiveness and a meaningfulness that sort of ties my whole life experience together.
Yes.
And is made visible for me in the roses I plant in my garden. You know, they speak to me of the links between my past and my present, and I think my future. And I think God just delights in showing us that the tapestry he's weaving is beautiful and whole and complete. even if often what we see is just kind of the messy underside of, you know, that you know, doesn't make such a pretty picture, but.
Right. Exactly. Oh, but what a beautiful word picture, though, as you turn that tapestry over and see that messy stuff underneath, you know, you realize the reality that it takes that to make, to create the beauty on the other side.
That's right.
But sometimes it's kind of mucky walking through the steps to get to that place.
Absolutely.
One of the things that you do in the book, and I'm not sure how large the piece of land that you're on is. I don't know if you tell about that in the book or not, but you talk about trees and and your love of trees. So I have a lot of tree jewelry. I absolutely love trees. My grandmother had me in a vacation Bible school when I was probably around five. She had me memorize Psalm 1, which talks about the trees, you know, growing by the rivers of water.
Yes.
And I know it by heart in the King James still, those things you memorize when you're a child come back to you or stay with you. So I've always loved trees and the tree metaphor. So I would love for you to, number one, talk about the size of your property, why trees are so important, and why you chose to really organize your book even using trees as chapter titles.
Yes. Well, you know, so this home, you brought up the question too of the name of a home earlier. And so this home is called Maplehurst, and we did not name it. It's had this name for over 100 years. And it's named, we think, obviously, for the maple trees that line the long driveway from the farmhouse to the road. So now those trees are all aging and we're trying to replant and care for them. But the name of the home is Maplehurst. So trees were always sort of a given, their importance here in this place. And hasn't always been easy. Those trees have needed a lot of care. Some of it has been expensive. The old trees are dying. You know, it's some of the hardest placemaking lessons I've learned here at Maplehurst have been in caring for these trees. But I have learned so much about trees, and like you, I always love those metaphors in scripture about living like a tree rooted by water. There's something about that image that is so powerful and just everything. It makes everything in me say, yes, that's what I want. I want to be that fruitful tree. And so I had a sense that, okay, if I can somehow weave my own stories of placemaking in with stories of the trees, if I pay attention to the trees, I bet there are things to learn. I learned so much, and Placemaker is just full of the, you know, fun tree discoveries that I made. But, you know, one thing is also I just wanted to take seriously for a moment the imagery that is in scripture of trees praising God and trees clapping their hands. And, you know, the more I learned about trees, the more I became convinced that this is true. This is real. You know, trees are, they're communicating. They're living in these rather complex communities. I mean, it's astonishing when you really dig in and learn about trees and forests. And so it really brought those scriptures to life and made me realize, oh my goodness, we as humans who are members of communities who are trying to figure out how to love our neighbors as ourselves, there is so much to be learned from the trees. So yes, every chapter is named after a different tree. I don't know if you have crepe myrtles in your part of Florida, but when we lived in northern Florida, we had a lot of crepe myrtles. And,
yes.
And in Texas growing up, we had a lot of crepe myrtles.
Texas, I know, have a lot of crepe myrtles. We don't have as many here in South Florida, Central South Florida, as we do.
The queen palms and maybe palmettos.
Yes, all of that. And the gold trees, the jacaranda trees, the poinciana trees or flame trees, depending on what you call them. And I'm loving all that, getting to know new trees
and also
wanting to get to know the different kinds of palm trees. You know, you mentioned a specific one. The coconut palms, the royal palms, they're all kinds of palm trees too. Why did you choose the kinds of trees that you did for your chapter titles? Are all of them represented on the property at Maplehurst, or are these favorites of yours?
These are all trees that were in the places that I write about, although with a twist. So you know, early in the book, I think one of the first chapters is named Citrus Grove.
Yes.
And actually that doesn't refer to real trees at all, but it was just the name of our little apartment complex when we lived in Orange, Texas.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, I included that to show that, you know, we were at the beginning of a journey and we had no idea where we would end up or how important trees would become. But even in that place that was in many ways a hard place, you know, the environment was not always well cared for in that place. There was some industry that was just not caring for that place. But even so, you know, when I remember our time there, I remember just the fruitfulness of community, and I remember so many beautiful guests. So I'm writing about real trees, but I think also with a nod that sometimes we're in environments where there are no trees growing, right? We're in deserts sometimes where what we feel mostly is the lack of trees. But also, I love the scripture where it says, you know, I think while I write a lot also about planting trees ourselves, I think one of the gifts of a desert or a wilderness season is that only God plants trees in those places. Only God causes water to flow there. And so when we're living through those seasons, we're just receiving. We're receiving, you know, like the Israelites receiving the manna and the quail. We just receive. We cannot make those trees grow ourselves.
No.
But gosh, see how I just weave in between the real and the metaphor.
Yes.
And the scripture. It's
yes.
all so, it's so woven together now in my life. I can hardly untangle those threads.
Well, and I think that's really important because, the real and the metaphor, I mean, they help us make sense of our lives as well.
Yes.
And yeah. I say that in the very best sense of that, not to, no pun intended, but because sometimes we can struggle with that. It felt like a major desert time when we first moved here. And I honestly, what I thought of was the seeds that I planted meeting one-on-one with women. Friends from the podcast, from my old radio show, would come here to Florida and say, hey, would you want to get together for coffee? And my answer, like before they could barely get it out, I'm like, yes, because
yes.
I was desperate. You know, I was desperate yes. for some kind of face-to-face community. It had not yet developed here in this new location. And I just kept planting seeds along the way. And you know, I knew that God had to water those, that
mm-hmm.
I didn't know what kind of community would spring up or when. I knew I wanted it now, but that was not mm-hmm. God's plan. There were other things that God was doing inside me, inside my husband, that needed to be tended to before we were going to grow community. And we also had to come to a place where, and my husband and I will joke about this, you know, he would say, we used to be somebody, which isn't
yes.
that funny. So identity things, of course,
yes.
our identity is rooted in Christ. Oh, but is it really?
Right.
You know, or is it in my former employ, you know, employment?
Yes.
How does that figure into the mix? And what is it that God is doing in me to root me more deeply in him and not the descriptor of what I was called or what I did.
I can relate. Absolutely. Yeah. It's one of the hardest things about uprooting ourselves and moving on is that we're not known in that place. And especially if our outer identity has changed, then we no longer have that shortcut answer. Well, I am this, I am that, because this is my job. And so not only is our, you know, our sort of insides, our interior unknown to the people around us, but we don't even have any longer the role or the job that we use to sort of explain ourselves to others. And that's definitely been my experience as we've moved from place to place. And it's, you know, it's just a hard thing. And that is one of the gifts of a longer time spent in a place, or, you know, just that is one of the gifts of home, is that we're known there. And and so when we don't have it, we really feel the lack of it. It's hard.
We ran into people who are now friends when we moved here, actually our next door neighbors, who took us aside and said, hey, we were depressed the first 2 years when we moved to Florida from Ohio. And I burst into tears because,
yes.
oh, you know my life. Oh, wow. We've only been here 2 months, but I'm feeling that. And even though it felt like, oh, really, 2 years? Do I have that to endure? Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't thinking that. It was just someone else has lived this, and they're mm-hmm. sharing that with me, that mm-hmm. where I am is okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is normal, you know?
This is normal, right. There's yeah. nothing wrong
There's
with
nothing
you.
There's nothing wrong
yeah.
with me. And yeah. they went on to say, we never guessed this when we made this move, but mm-hmm. some of the best friends of our lives have been made since we made this move to mm-hmm. Sarasota. So while that's really hard for me, even still, to comprehend, mm-hmm. I can hold on to the coattails of my neighbors and you know, believe that a little bit as I see it lived out through them mm-hmm. and in them, you know.
What wisdom. What incredible neighbors. What a gift. Wow.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A former Mennonite pastor, and then my husband's a former pastor. And we both learned about the other, that we were moving next door to a pastor and that a pastor was moving in, and we both didn't want to move in next to a pastor because we thought, oh no, what might this be like?
Yeah,
so it's really funny. And God's gift of grace was mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. And it's been a wonderful relationship moving in next door to them. I want to know if you as an author can or do have a favorite chapter. You know, it's like asking an author to pick a favorite book. It's like your kids, you can't do that. But is there a chapter that you just love and love talking about more than others?
Yeah.
You can pick a couple. It doesn't matter.
I think first, you know, you won't be surprised to hear, I think it is chapter 11 where I write not just about trees, but I write about the roses.
Yes.
So I've said again and again in this conversation already how much I love flowers, how much beauty means to me. And so writing that chapter about our flower garden and also about our family, you know, how our family walked through that season of loss and pain, and when my sister lost her husband and how the garden ministered to us. Mm. That is the chapter that is most precious to me personally. Mm. And also, you know, I wrote a lot about the history of these antique roses that were almost lost to gardens and cultivation. And that history is just so fascinating and fun to me. But I also tell a lot of stories, and this pops up in a couple chapters. It's the pin oak, and by pin I mean William Penn. So here in Pennsylvania, we have a few left of these very special white oak trees. And they're called pin oaks because they were already growing here the last time William Penn visited his little fledgling colony. So they may have been, you know, barely beyond acorn stage, but they're that old. Hmm. And we have one not on our property, which is, you know, we have about 4.5 acres here, but on the edge of our property, it now sits on the edge of a suburban golf course.
Wow.
But there is an old pin oak. It looks like I want to say it looks alive. Of course, trees are alive. It looks more alive than a tree. It looks like a creature, an animal, wild greenish gray hair. And while you can never know a tree's age exactly until you cut it down and count the rings,
right.
They do estimate age. And this one has a little plaque that names it and says that it's believed to be from the year 1643.
Wow.
So just the... to be in the presence of a tree like that. So I had, when I was writing Placemaker, I had to find ways as often as I could in each chapter to weave in the story of this oak tree that,
I love that.
To me, it just looks like it's dancing over there. It's just dancing in the wind and has been there for hundreds of years. So I feel like a tree like that is the nearest maybe that we come to really a glimpse of eternity, of a timeline that is so much deeper than just our own lives. And it's a beautiful thing to behold.
I remember, I love that. It brings me to a memory when I was in Israel once in the Garden of Gethsemane, and you look at these gnarled olive trees. And I remember sitting there and think, just they look old, and some of them are, you can tell. I don't know the age, but I just sat there and thought, could any of these be witnesses to Jesus here when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane? I don't know that, but that's what it made me think of.
That's incredible, and I think that is possible. I don't write about olives in this book, but I've read a bit about them, and I know some can be thousands of years old. So it is actually possible that some of those witnessed his pain and his tears, and it's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
I feel like it links us. It links us to that path just in a really solid, visceral way.
I am so with you. I love that. How would you, maybe this takes you out of your book Placemaker, but I don't think so. How would you go about naming a house? You know, to my mind, like,
Oh, I'm so glad you asked, because one of the things, you know, I don't know that I myself, before Maplehurst, would have had what felt like maybe the audacity, right, to name my home. And yet, I think, you know, they do this in other countries. They obviously did it in the past in our own country. Why wouldn't we give a name to the place that, more than just home, right? The place that is there for us, that is nourishing us. And so I feel like I've become a bit of an evangelist for naming your own home.
Let me just say this little piece, because, and I have not thought this through, but I'll have to sit with this a little later, but we live in a manufactured home. And so, you know, which you can use many words, we choose to use the word manufactured home. People around us choose that. But you could use the word mobile home. Well, there's nothing mobile about it. You know, you don't hook it up to anything and pull it somewhere. But, and so it's only been here maybe since about 1975. So that, you know, I know the age, but I know what I feel like when I walk into my home. And so I realize that I have attached like some feelings to when I'm in this space, and that's, I probably need to sit with some of that.
That's a great idea.
Any other counsel you have?
I think it is about listening. You know, we talked about the importance of listening to a place, and it sounds like, mobile home or not, your home has some history. It has been there, and already in the time you've spent there, it has served you in certain ways. And so taking the time to listen, I just think naming a home is a way of honoring a place, even if we think of it as a humble place. Or, you know, and I think that's maybe what keeps people from naming. Though they think, well, I don't live in a castle. I don't live in a mansion. Why? You know, and I'll say too, my home has a name, but it's still a farmhouse. It is still a simple red brick farmhouse. In that sense, it is not, it's not a mansion. It's not fancy. It's old, but it's not fancy. So I think we honor our homes and the value that they have in our lives. I think we honor them as gifts given to us by God. I think it may even be the thing that helps inspire us to care for them a little better, to not see them as inconveniences or burdens, which often, you know, when you've got to mow the lawn again, it can feel like a burden, like an inconvenience. But everything worth loving can feel like an inconvenience, but love is inconvenient, right? But it's so good, you know?
Well, and
so naming is good for that.
And let me ask you this too. I can imagine someone listening to this conversation and thinking, oh, yeah, I could name it if I lived in a Maplehurst, or, oh, my dream has been to own a plot of ground and to, you know, Christie's life. Going back to what you said at the very beginning, you know, there's romance attached to the sound of the life that she's living. We do not need to be living in a farmhouse on a plot of land. To be placemakers. I think it's implicit in what we're talking about, but I guess I want to circle back around and have you reiterate that.
And you know what? So I'm going to do that by admitting something to you that I have not admitted about this book and about that chapter I mentioned, Citrus Grove, which, you know, I said was the name of our apartment complex. So I'm going to tell you the whole story.
Okay. All right.
So in my mind, the places where we lived, including that apartment, didn't necessarily had names, or if they had official apartment names, maybe some of them I had forgotten. But in writing the stories and digging into my past, I was digging into what was meaningful about those places, what they had, you know, what gifts they had given me, what did I learn there? And so I knew that I needed to give each one a name for the purpose of the storytelling. So that apartment complex was in the town of Orange, Texas, which is why I named it myself, Citrus Grove Apartment. But that wasn't the name. It had some sort of terrible anonymous name that meant nothing to me.
Sure.
But I changed the name for the purpose of the book because I knew that that name would communicate something about that, something true about the place.
Yes.
And Citrus Grove was more true than the actual name.
Yes.
So I think, I think that's the power of a name.
Yes.
And I think that's the power of naming or renaming those places that maybe have felt too humble, too small, or too inadequate. We can rename them almost like a blessing over them. We're blessing that place, it's a way of showing gratitude for that place. So when I renamed that apartment building, I could feel something shift in my memories. That place looked a little different to me now. The importance of it was I could sort of see it in a way that I hadn't been able to see it before. So it may be that naming a home that we think is small or humble might be one of the most important ways that we can change the way we see that place.
And I'll tell you what it makes me think of as you were telling that story. I just thought of the names of your former places. Mm-hmm. Stacked up like stones of remembrance.
Right? Yes, Ebenezer Stones.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
so
I love that.
Another, I think, reason. It's another visual, and that's beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. I could keep talking to you forever on this. I love this topic. My husband's alma mater, Northern Minnesota, St. John's University. It's a Catholic monastery and university.
Oh, I've been there. It's a lovely campus.
Yes, it is. I love going there. I've been there on retreat. And so there's a book. I have no idea. We have it. I don't know. It's a book of essays. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. But it's called A Sense of Place. It just reminds me of placemaking and how, not that this is another word for it, but we have to, I think it's helpful to develop a sense of place wherever we are. It plays into placemaking.
Absolutely.
But now why did that come to me? I think because I want a couple more things to hear from you. I want to hear what you think has been the biggest challenge when it comes to placemaking, and maybe you've already expressed it and you can reiterate that. And then I want to hear really what your biggest hope is for readers, what you hope they take away from placemaking. And I'll admit to my listeners that this is one of those books because Christy has a PhD in English literature. She is a marvelous writer, and you're going to want to savor this book and read it slowly. And so that's what I am currently doing. So, I want to encourage you in that, but what do you hope people will take away? And what's also been that biggest challenge in placemaking for you?
Mm-hmm. You know, I know the answer to that question, and I always hesitate to give it because it sounds very unspiritual.
Well.
Here we go. You're going to hear it from me. But the answer is really being willing to appear foolish in my finances. So I think we can...
Say more.
I can
more.
At least. I can sort of give everything up to God and say, God, I'm willing to follow you, even if it makes me look foolish to the world. But I think a lot of us, if you're like me, we hold back in the area of our finances because, there's good wisdom out there that tells us this is how you manage your finances well. And none of those books, none of those classes will tell you to pour your money into restoring an old farmhouse. It makes no sense. It makes no sense financially. It is, I think, on every level a foolish thing to do in those terms. And yet, I know God's called me to this work. Mm. And I know that even though this house sometimes feels like a money pit, I know that the story being written here is much, much bigger than the state of my bank account. But it's a challenge that I still struggle with it because I know that there are no guarantees and that... You know, we might you know, we might face, you know, real financial struggle and who knows? And I know I will be embarrassed.
But you know what? You're pointing back to the importance of creating beauty. You're pointing back to several things that we've talked about earlier.
Yes, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, but you're kind of sitting on a nerve with me and my husband, probably. This is a good conversation starter later.
And
so I want to wait now for just a second on, you know, what your hope is for people who read the book, because I want to ask this. Mm-hmm. What are the ages of your children now as we speak today?
Yeah, and I feel this is a relevant question in one regard, because my youngest is in kindergarten. My oldest is in high school, just started high school. And so we have the prospect of their futures now, and we're thinking about college, and we're thinking about that high cost. And every day, if we pay some bill for the house, some work that we feel called to do here, I'm looking at that check I'm writing and I'm thinking, but this is money I cannot give to my child to help them.
So,
and that is hard.
But
that
so is this so is hard. This is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking on the flip side of that, which I'm sure you are as well, but the flip side of that is look at what you're modeling for your children in the placemaking arena here, right? Yeah.
I think so. And, you know, for instance, one of the things we've recently spent some money on is restoring an old barn on the property that we hope to be able to host gatherings and maybe retreats. And we really feel called to that work. So when my children say, "Mom, we want a swimming pool."
Oh, right, right.
I have to tell them, you know, there won't be a swimming pool because we've spent any money that might have ever gone to a swimming pool on this, which is for other people. And I would love to give them a swimming pool, but you're right. I hope I'm giving them a sense that we don't live for ourselves. We don't even spend our money just, you know, it really isn't ours to begin with. And I hope they're, I think they're seeing it. It isn't easy. Of course, we all want a swimming pool.
There you go. Oh, that's great. I love that. So what do you hope people will take away from the book when they read it?
You know, I hope, my hope as a writer always is that I feel like if I have any gift to cultivate, it's the gift of seeing, observing, noticing, especially the beauty in the world. And I hope that the book is a chance for readers to sort of borrow my eyes for a while. You know, it's almost like putting on another pair of glasses. Mm-hmm. And I hope that the beauty of the trees and of creation and all the places where I've lived and how that has inspired me and blessed me, I hope mostly and primarily that it blesses and inspires every reader, that the chance to see the world through my eyes for a while is a chance to maybe just see in a way that they haven't before. And that when they turn that last page and they, you know, set my eyes aside, that they've been given, hopefully, possibly, new eyes to see their own places, their own home, and to see them with more love and more gratitude. And so it isn't, you know, maybe this book will inspire someone to go out and plant a garden. Who knows? But that is, you know, that's a much smaller hope than just this hope that readers will have new eyes to see their own home.
Yeah, maybe it'll inspire someone else to name their home. Like
I
me.
Love it. I hope so.
Wow. Well, I know one thing. This conversation has elicited all kinds of questions that people can sit with. It certainly has for me, and I hope they do that. Thank you so much for being on the podcast, Christy. What a joy. Again, Christy Purifoy, and the name of her book is Placemaker, Cultivating Places of Comfort, Beauty, and Peace. Yeah, it's calling to you. I know it is. Christy, thank you.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
And to everyone else, I say keep the conversation going.